Today we have geopolitical expert Matt Gerken to discuss Doge, the Middle East, and more.
This is Jerry Toome of Smart Money, a broadcast of Cornerstone Financial Services with Cornerstone President and Founder, Jerry Toome. Jerry Toome is a certified financial planner. Securities and advisory services offered through Independent Financial Group, LLC, a registered investment advisor, member, FINRA, and SIPC. Cornerstone Financial Services and Independent Financial Group, LLC, are unaffiliated entities. Views and opinions heard on Jerry Toome's Smart Money are not necessarily the opinion of this station or its management or Independent Financial Group, LLC, its affiliates, officers, or directors. Material on this program is intended for general information only and should not be taken as specific investment, tax, or legal advice. We are here to talk about your finances, investments, and the economy, and we are aiming to change the way America thinks about investing.
Welcome to Smart Money with Jerry Toome. This is Michael Williams. Well, Jerry, we do have a great interview that starts today and will finish next week with Matt Gerken of BCA, probably our favorite geopolitical expert that we talked to. We've interviewed in the past, and it is a very good interview. Today, we'll cover Doge in the Middle East. Next week, we will talk to him about Russia, China, and the South China Sea. So we'd highly recommend
geopolitics.
You listen to the interview because
it's really outstanding. You know, it's really a blessing to me that we're getting the quality of interviews that we're getting right now is just off the charts. And Matt is my favorite geopolitical expert, and he speaks very well. He makes sense. It's so funny though, when we were doing one of the questions, and I won't tell you which one this is. I won't tell the audience which one. It stumped him for a minute. I don't know if you noticed that or not, because we were doing it on Zoom
right
together, and he had to stop for a minute and think on that one. He said, "That's a really good question." So I'm not going to tell the audience which one. You'll have to listen to both this week and next week to find out when did Jerry almost stump Matt, but he came back. He had a great response when he said that, but he had to think about it for a moment. And today's topic, the most important thing to me, and I'll just give you kind of a preview, and then we'll go into our regular part of the show. The issue, clearly we're still in recovery. Clearly we're still in a bull market. I mean, I remember several months ago saying, well, by February I may decide that I'm wrong and I have to apologize. And well, here we are. It's February. I thought about that. Okay. So we didn't have a massive bear, yet. We are still in a recovery. I'm not convinced any of that would have happened if Trump had not won and won with such decisive force. The difference in the media interviews that I've seen, and I don't watch a whole lot of this stuff, but I've seen some on Facebook and places like that. Trump is being, and from what I can see, a little less confrontational and a little less angry toward the reporters, but they're also being a lot more diplomatic toward him. And he's got a 28-year-old girl that you can't beat a girl up, you know. So it's making it where it's a whole lot more genteel, if you will, in the. It's still combat, but it's not combat with, you know, battle axes and stuff like that. So the issue is we're really in a different season of life. The liberals have not figured out yet what his game plan is, and they're way behind him right now. So I will say that's a good thing for the economy. Historically speaking, what you find most of the time, past performance, no guarantee future results. Most of the time, year one is not when you have a bear market for a president's term. It's usually in year two. But again, past performance, no guarantee of future returns. The issue to me where I see the big risk, and this is something we talked about last year, Michael, I don't know how many times I said this, we talked about it. I kept saying over and over and over again, I don't know what will trigger a bear, but I think it'll be geopolitical, but I'm not sure what that will be.
Right.
All right, so when we interview Matt Gerken in a moment, you're going to hear. So we're not trying to be doom and gloomers. We're not, you know, we're optimists too.
Right now we're positive on the market.
Right now we're positive on the market.
Just cautious.
We're also in the market, but we also recognize, number one, the market is not just at historic highs. If you look at the price-to-earnings ratio, price-to-sales, I won't go into great detail. We've covered that a lot in the last few months. We're at historic levels of valuation and overvaluation, and hey, David McCord pulled some numbers on what we call insider selling. Now, you've been with us a long time. You had two stints. First stint was starting in 2001, I think.
Yes.
I remember right after you got your finished your master's in statistics after your master's in financial planning, or the other way around, and then
that's
you got
right.
your CFP. But bottom line is, we haven't seen huge record of insider selling like this from what I remember since the dot-com era. And I do remember saying last year this reminded me more of the dot-com. It didn't seem like it was going to be like 2008. And those of you that remember that, if you don't remember all the details, which most of you probably don't, in 2000, 2001, 2002, we barely even had a recession. We had a mild recession. We had two downturn quarters, two negative quarters of GDP, but mm-hmm. they weren't even consecutive.
Right.
So later on, the NFIB came along and said, oh, by the way, we think that was a recession. Well, they told us that, you know, 9 months later. I'm like, yeah, thanks a lot. Okay, well, the market reacted to this a year ago, and you're telling me now, oh, it turned out it was an official recession. Oh, okay, come on, give me a break. But we had massive overvaluation in the techs. That was a record mania, the dot-coms. Kind of like I love to tell a story about Yogi Berra, you know, and his son Dale, when the reporters, because Yogi Berra, everybody chased him around hoping he would come up with something funny, because he always did, and it was always by accident. And they asked his son, are you like your dad? And he said, no, our similarities are different. And so it's like, okay, well, the similarities between this era and the dot-com era are different. This time we don't have a whole bunch of stocks that have no earnings and no hope for earnings that are we call them concept stocks in the aftermath. And by God's grace, we were right on that one for sure. We were right on most of the turning points in the market over the past 30, 40 years, not all of them, not 100%. But the bottom line is I remember saying, hey, these stocks are not, they're phantoms.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have any earnings. They don't even have a good business plan. It's just a feeding frenzy like piranha eating a cow in the Amazon River, like you've seen some of the Wild Kingdom kind of things. And it's just there's no chances. And I still remember 2 years after, you know, the Super Bowl in 2000, it seemed like, it's probably not this high, maybe 30%. It seemed like 50% of the ads were dot-coms.
Right, money coming out of the wazoo.
Exactly, and they had so much money they didn't know what to do, so they bought a Super Bowl ad. Well, 2 years later, there's another one where it's like Lone Rider, you know, Clint Eastwood, woo, or, you know, Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. He's riding his horse real slow through the cemetery, and it's dark, and it's stormy outside, but it's not raining, but he looks... Rip.com here, rip.com here, rest in peace. Anyway, I thought it was pretty cool, pretty clever commercial. Anyway,
yep.
I'm getting far afield here, but the bottom line is
Well, I would add to that, the other similarity that's different, sentiment. There's a lot of high sentiment right now.
Yeah, it's very high.
But it's not as emotional as it was
Correct.
In the dot-coms.
No.
And it's not your friend or neighbor that doesn't usually invest, all of a sudden, hey, I've got this great stock tip.
I know.
It's more the sentiment of the people that are already in the market.
It's the more... more seasoned people, the more wealthy people, and people that bought wisdom with pain during those last two
yes.
bears. That's basically what it is. And so what you've got to do is look at, okay, there are some similarities, there are some differences. The differences are, again, instead of that bull market being built on phantom, you know, vapor, which no earnings for vast majority of those, it got so bad, you and I were talking about this before the show. Maybe you all remember this, maybe you won't. But Barron's came out with an article in October or November. I think it was October of 2002 when the bear market had hit its bottom, final bottom, and had another bottom right before the war when we invaded Afghanistan. But the issue was they had a big article about there are dot-coms out there, and they listed 20 or 30 of them.
Mm-hmm.
That had actual earnings, not just projected hope and hype, someday we might make a profit, which most of those vanished. I don't remember how many, but there were thousands of them that went bankrupt. And here's a list of the ones that have actual earnings, number one. Number two, their stock is so low because the sentiment went from extreme euphoria to extreme depression over that swing in 3 years. And a three-year bear market is a long time.
Yes.
It's a, you know... That one and the Great Depression were the two longest in terms of duration that we've ever seen. That one from 1929 to 1932. Anyway, the bottom line is that those companies that were they listed a bunch of companies that were their market capitalization, the value of the stock, was less than the cash sitting in the bank, and they had operating earnings. So I remember when the price earnings ratio of NASDAQ went to infinity.
Right.
Do you remember that?
Yep, because no earnings.
Basically, there were no earnings. That was insanity. So it was a classic case of extreme psychology, extreme sentiment. Now, we're not in the same situation today. The Mag 7 have magnificent earnings.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't run a bull market for the long term on 7 stocks. Nothing can be guaranteed about what I'm about to say here, but that is unstable. Think of a building. If you had a building and it's a 20-story building and it's got one pillar at the bottom holding it up, that's not stable.
Right.
All right. So no matter how good these 7 stocks have done and may continue to do, even though I think the bloom's off the rose, I think they've probably peaked out in their relative strength versus the rest of the market. And I think one of the things that you're going to see that we're talking about here, insider selling, we haven't seen in this kind of magnitude in a long time. Let me just read you from the Kobisi letter. Dave McCord, our president and charter market technician, pulled this up. Real brief article. Excuse me. Real brief article. It says, U.S. executives are selling stock at a record pace. The ratio of insider buyers to sellers dropped to 0.22. That means basically one buying for every 5 selling, five selling.
Mm-hmm.
The lowest since 1988 when the data began. Now, if it's the lowest since 1988, that might be meaningful. Beware the extremes. They said this is January, only 98 firms had at least one insider who bought shares compared to 447 firms with at least one insider who sold. Now, insiders, that's corporate directors and large shareholders. It's people that the SEC and so forth, they believe will influence the stock. You know, so they're kind of in the know. They're going to know. They're called insiders for a reason.
Right.
Why? Because they know what's going on inside the company and other people don't have access to that information. So they can't give you anything more than the published reports are going to give you. You know, they give you the 10-Qs, they give you the earnings reports and all that fun stuff. But if you watch what they're doing instead of what they're saying, that's when you get clues. You know, Mark Cuban sold too soon, but he sold and still became a billionaire. And if he'd waited, who knows what would have happened. So we had record insider selling back in 1999-ish, which is one of the reasons that we balanced the budget under Newt Gingrich and Bill Clinton. Why? Because you had record capital gains tax.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually, they did attack government spending. But the thing that put them over the top was massive capital gains tax because of the dot-coms in 2000. So anyway, this month only 98 firms had at least one insider who bought shares versus 447. So what you're seeing is about a 5-to-1 ratio, 4.5, 5-to-1 ratio of sellers versus buyers. Now, again, insiders can sell for a lot of reasons.
Right.
Just
diversification.
It's state taxing. State tax issues, diversification, might be a good time to take gains. You're taxing gains. You're not taxing losses here, typically. Anyway, so there are a lot of different reasons why insiders might want to sell, but when it happens in mass, when it's kind of like you open the floodgates and the floodgates become Niagara Falls, then you know, wait a minute, if all the rats are jumping off the ship, maybe there's something wrong with the ship, dude. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with individual companies. I'm saying that buy low, sell high operates in the corporate boardroom sometimes. And I think that they're going, hey, this is a pretty good opportunity to sell high. And maybe they bought a whole lot lower. Now, and then this history doesn't have to repeat itself.
Right.
But in the 1999-2000 era, what happened? Huge amounts of insiders sold, knowing that their gains were phantom gains, if you will. Many of them, not all of them, who bought? The general public.
Yep.
General public loaded the boat with the dot-coms.
But this is like valuations. It's a warning sign.
It's not a timing.
It can
indicator.
Go on for a long time. It doesn't tell you when anything's going to
happen.
Exactly. No. To me, it reminds me of my car when I turn it on. It said roads may be icy. Well, the conditions are cold enough, but it doesn't know if it rained or not.
No. So this is not what I would call a sell signal. This is a warning signal. So I still love the old Lost in Space from when I was a kid. Right. Warning, warning, Will Robinson. There's a monster around the boulder, which is fake boulder made out of paper mache. But anyway, bottom line is that this is something to watch. It's not something to bail on. It's something to watch. In the meantime, we've got all this subterfuge. I mean, what's going on in Washington, it reminds me of you envision an old World War II movie, and the guys are flying the plane, the World War II plane, and they've got a really dangerous mission. They're going to blow up a dam in Germany or something like that, and you see the anti-aircraft flak. Boom, boom, boom. The bombs are just hitting all around their plane, and they're trying to hold it together, and it's shaking. And it's like this is craziness that's going on in Washington. It's great craziness, you know, but it's craziness. And I'm like, okay, we were talking, we've been looking at Strategus, which is a service, really high-end stuff, very good in Washington. And the guy, you mentioned the guy that's their main political analyst. Dan Clifton said, now, if I'm doing the middle of this webcast and they change something big, come tell me so I can change my opinion on that second. So it's like,
yeah, because okay. He was answering people's questions, but he said, you know, as fast as the Trump administration's doing this, my answer could be wrong any minute now.
Yeah, that's right. It's craziness. So anyhow, on the stock market, we're bullish. The odds, again, are normally you don't have a bear in the first year of president's administration. The key, and I think the black swan issue, and I'll talk about this briefly, and then you can hear the interview with Matt Gertkin. Matt, again, is my favorite geopolitical analyst with Bank Credit Analyst. He's got six people on his team, six other economists and geopolitical analysts on his team. So this is a worldwide organization. Last time I checked, they had 60 analysts, 60 economists or analysts, and worldwide, various offices around the world. Anyway, I did a double take. When I saw his report, we got a couple of copies. You went and saw him in person. I wasn't able to be there. But the bottom line is he sent this report out, and I literally did a double take. I'm like, boing, wait a minute, time out. I had to back up and say, what? I've never seen Matt give the odds of something as high as he did on a major dispute, not a little one, not more skirmishes, between Israel and Iran. I've never seen him put a number on anything geopolitically that high. And he's not a sensationalist. He's not a...
And he didn't extend his time period to make that.
No.
It's a 12 to 18 month time period.
And so he put the odds that Israel will try to do it, will take out Iran at 75% in the year of 2025. I'm like, holy cow. That's a high risk. When you narrow that to 1 year and you're a strategist and people are going to judge you based on what you said. And I told him that. I said, Matt, I've never seen you go this high on any number. And he went on to explain why. So we'll talk about that. He thinks the odds are very high that Israel sees this basically as a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for most of the people that live currently in Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay, if we lose this window of opportunity, we've got Hamas mostly defeated, Hezbollah mostly defeated, Houthis are at least calm for the moment, Syria's gone, so that removes a big chunk of ally for Iran. And the people in Iran hate the regime, typically. Almost all of them do. It's a very unpopular regime with the people. And they're like, okay, we got a once-in-a-lifetime shot here, and a window's opened up. And as Matt pointed out, 5 years from now, who knows who's going to be president of the United States? Who knows what, you know, they have a chance to rebuild? It's just like, okay. So I don't know if he's going to be right or not, but I had this feeling, and we talked about this multiple times last year, I had this feeling, I said, okay, all I can do is tell you I think there's a black swan coming at some point. Black swan is an unpredictable event that has enormous impact on the economies of the market and so forth. And I said I think it's going to be geopolitical, just a gut feeling. I'm like, I can't pinpoint what, but I've been saying that probably for at least a year, I would think. So anyway, that's going to be the remainder of the broadcast in a moment. We'll talk around it. In the meantime, stocks are rotating a little bit. Will it last? Is tech going to come out? I think that the odds, my personal opinion at the moment, is that the Magnificent Seven doesn't mean they're going to go away, but I think the bloom is probably off the rose, meaning I don't think they're going to be the most popular names on the planet this year. I think it probably peaked out last year. Reserve the right to change my opinion later. Optimism is still very high, according to all the polls that Ned Davis came up with. The earnings are doing great so far, 62%, according to Strategus, beat their fourth quarter estimates on revenue, 79% on earnings, 83% on the Mag 7 in terms of beating their earnings estimates. They also pointed out that when the dollar is strong, which it has been, it hurts companies that have more sales overseas, and the tech is the most exposed there. So I do think that the market is in a bull market still. I don't see a top yet, but I'm watching very closely, and I think that what we're going to have to do is watch that very closely, because I think I don't see Trump as wrecking this whole thing. I don't see him turning over the apple cart. I think that if we have a bear coming, which eventually you will have, it's just a matter of when, then I think the likelihood is it's coming from geopolitical issues.
Well, we'd like to take a moment before I continue on with Jerry. When we come back, I would like for him to touch a little bit on inflation. And, of course, we've got that very good first half of the interview with Matt Gerken. But I'd also like to remind you, if you want to learn more about Cornerstone Financial Services, if you listen to our show and you like how we look at the markets, that we look at the macro first, looking at what's going on in the big picture, and then we go in and we make adjustments to our investments. We don't just buy and hold. We are tactical. So we adjust to what's going on in the economy and the markets. If you want to learn more about that, you could reach out to us at 1-800-327-4285. It's 1-800-327-4285. Or our website, cornerstonereport.com. That's cornerstonereport.com. Again, there you can learn about us. You can get Jerry's special reports, which in a couple weeks or so, you're probably going to have a brand new one coming out. You can listen to our previous broadcasts and interviews. And as always, starting a few months ago, you can now catch us on podcast, whether it's through Apple, Spotify, or Amazon Audible, whichever one you prefer, you can catch us there.
And send email or forward it to your friends.
That's right. To find it there on the podcast, you can just search for Jerry Tuma. It's technically called Jerry Tuma's Smart Money, but with Jerry's name, it's easy to find, T-U-M-A, Jerry Tuma. All right, Jerry, so before we get to our interview with Matt Gerken, there's a few things you want to cover.
A couple of housekeeping issues. Again, I forgot to mention in the beginning of the show, the Consumer Price Index and the Producer Price Index came out hotter than expected this week, and that really shouldn't be much of a surprise. In other words, we've been talking about this. Mm-hmm. Inflation was going to come in at least two waves, maybe three. And the battle for inflation clearly is not over. Strategus had a really good article on that. One of the things they point out, now this is really important here because this is what's going on, they put together a common man consumer price index, meaning stuff that, you know, this includes food, energy, shelter, clothing, utilities, insurance, stuff that everybody has to buy. That's the common man index versus wages. And for the last 4 years, 23% gap between those two.
Hmm.
So what you're seeing,
I mean, the costs were 23% higher than wages increase.
Correct. There's a 23% differential since 2021. So the cost of living has gone up 23% more than the average wages have in this country. Now, if you look back when Trump was in office before, oh, let's not get political here. Of course not. Of course not. Wages exceeded prices in those 4 years. So it was in reverse. You had more in wage gains than you did in price gains of the
right.
same index, the same products, if you will. And so the bottom line is, investors think about the consumer price index on a rate of change basis. Well, inflation's down. It's only 3.6, whatever it was. And there's so many different ways to slice it. You know, okay, it's in the 3% range, 3 to 4% range right now. The Fed supposedly wants it at 2. They found out, Strategus pointed out, yeah, that came from Denmark 40 years ago, that's the
right.
target that they all, I'm like, are you serious? This is from Denmark? That's where we got the 2% target that we have to hit? Well, okay, give me a break. But anyway, clearly the inflation battle is not over. So when is it going to be over? Not until we have another recession. And then it's going to come back again real strong, almost certainly. If you remember what we've talked about many times before, Alan Greenspan made a comment, and he went on a campaign. He was on a crusade back around 2017 of saying the next decade will be like the 1970s. Which was foreign, you know, for most people at the time, it's okay, you might as well be speaking Russian. How can you believe that? You know, one of Clinton's guys, and I'm spacing on the name right now, anyway, came out and said, it's secular stagnation. Oh, we're going to be stagnant pricing, stagnant deflationary pressure, stagnant economy for, a long time, as far as I can see. Well, he was wrong. Anyway, that was widely accepted by Wall Street. Alan Greenspan is out there going, wait a minute, no, it's going to be like the 70s. And what are we seeing? We're seeing inflation very similar to the 1970s right now. So the question to me is not, is there another wave coming? The question to me is this wave number one we've just been through, or is it wave number two? Because there were three waves in the late 60s and 70s. It didn't get as much attention during the late 60s because we were all embroiled over the Vietnam War. But there was a pretty good surge of inflation in the late 60s, early 70s. Then it came back down, then another upswing, and then it came back down. And the final wave was the big wave under Jimmy Carter. Reality is we got probably, I'd be surprised if we don't have three runs this time. Trump will do everything in his power to keep it down for the next year or two. Right now, we're still feeding off what was already in the pipeline, what was already in the system. He's going to try to bring it back down. He hopes he's successful, and I think he will be successful to a degree. The problem in the long run is you can't control oil. Drill, baby, drill is great, but what are you going to do with Iran? Matt Gerken's going to talk about that in just a moment. What are you going to do with Russia? There's geopolitical, the game's afoot, Sherlock right. Holmes used to say to Watson, okay, there's the game's afoot, Watson. So we've got to sit there and go, wait a minute.
Housing shortages. You can't fix that overnight.
No, let's go out and we'll do 3D printing to create 4 million houses to take care of the shortage. So housing's not an uptrend.
Shortage of workers.
Workers.
Yeah, there's just things that are all inflationary.
I still remember the Imperials, a gospel singing group, when I first got to know the Lord back in the late 80s, had a song about there's a shortage of everything, because there were shortages everywhere in the late 70s, except for God's love, they said. So anyway, that you can take that or leave that. One other interesting piece of trivia, Strategus points out, this is important. This is a good thing to listen to for a second. All the job gains in 2024, guess where one-fourth of them came from? Government spending! 23% of all job gains in 2024 came from government. And did it get backloaded? Get it pushed in? The shenanigans in Washington, I've never seen anything like this in my lifetime. And we're going to let Matt talk about that a little bit here. We'll talk about what I think is the primary big risk to a bear market. If we have a bear market, I think it's likely what I've been saying is probably will be not right away, probably not the first 6 months of this year, maybe in the second half of this year, maybe in next year, but it's geopolitical. I'm leaning toward the second half of this year, but it will be geopolitically driven, almost certainly, clearly a black swan. The issue is, what are you going to do with Iran? We're going to talk with Matt Gerken here. Let's talk first about Doge, then we're going to talk about Iran. Let's talk to Matt.
We have as our guest today Matt Gerken, who is the chief geopolitical strategist for Bank Credit Analyst, one of the favorite reports that I read in all the research that I do. I went through, Michael saw me, I was preparing for our next newsletter this morning, and I had a trash can, a big 22-gallon trash can kind of thing that's about half full of all the stuff I threw away from all the reading, but I never throw Matt's stuff away. It's always right on and right on time. And Matt, you shocked me. I have to say that. It was a shock. I'm reading your special report, 5 Black Swans for 2025. Now, I've read you for a long time, and I know you're not a sensationalist. You don't exaggerate. You don't overhype for marketing's sake. And when I read your report, I'm like, this is crazy. I did a double take. I'm like, wait a minute. What did he say? Now, I'm going to come back to that in just a moment. So the audience, I have to keep suspended in animation about what you shocked me on. But I want, if it's okay with you, I want to start domestically. The Doge and the budget. I mean, I've lived through balanced budget amendment. I've lived through the contract with America and all that stuff. This one looks like it might have some teeth, but that's not my specialty. My question, I guess, for you is, can it really work this time? How far can they take these budget cuts? Is it something we're really going to reform government and it's going to change the trajectory of the national debt of the U.S. government? What's your take, Matt?
Well, thanks, Jerry. Well, I do think it's going to be significant. I think you're right that the explosion of inflation that we saw in the wake of the pandemic has generated some political capital for cutting of red tape, deregulation of the economy, and also shaking up the bureaucracy. And President Trump's reelection was a historic comeback, And he, of course, had long been saying that he wanted to drain the swamp and shake up Washington. So I think that's all happening, and I think it's happening very quickly, so that we already will witness impacts from what's been done. Just, cutting some agencies, firing different staff members. This is a huge shakeup of the federal government. But in terms of the size of government and the size of cuts, that's probably overrated. The original idea was a $2 or $2.5 trillion cut to spending over 10 years, and that has already been admitted to be not very likely by the House Speaker Mike Johnson, who's really looking at something closer to 1.3 or 1.5 trillion over 10 years. So they've already sort of cut in half the size of federal spending cuts that they think they can get away with. And even that, I've looked at this issue just going through with a hatchet, not a scalpel,
Right.
looking at non-defense discretionary spending. I was able to get 1.3 trillion on a that's a very generous number. I mean, really, the federal cuts may not be that high. So spending cuts are hard to do because every single piece of spending has already been advocated for by Congress people, by lawmakers, and they're defending their districts. And so you can cut waste, but it'll probably prove a little bit disappointing. And then I'll conclude by saying that the impact of that for those who are listening is, well, it means that the tax cuts will have to they'll be lowering revenue, but you won't get as much spending cuts as you expected, and therefore the budget deficit impact will probably be larger than anticipated.
Well, I think that's right, but I wanted to hear your opinion on it. And I'm looking at it also, and I've looked at this issue for a long time. Let's just call it the demographic time bomb. You've got Social Security, which supposedly goes broke in 2032, I think, which of course we know is more or less fictional anyway, because it's a budgetary issue, and we all know the story. Congress already borrowed all the money out and spent it, so there's now a trust fund that you can carry around in a briefcase, basically. But Medicare, of course, is the big gorilla. Everything I've seen, there's a guy named Ken Dykewald that wrote a book called Age Wave years ago. He pointed out that the issue with Medicare, he said, at this point, and I think this is still accurate, but this is a number of years ago, he said that the vast majority of the expenses, something like two-thirds of all Medicare expenses, are incurred in the last 9 months of a fatal illness. Now we've got the baby boomers. As you know, we've talked extensively. I think you have our book From Boom to Bust and Beyond. We talk about demographics, demographics, and demographics. Now we have this monster, what to me looks like a ticking time bomb of entitlements. And if we don't turn the trajectory of the budget around, which again, I agree with you, I don't think it's going to turn the trajectory. We're kind of cutting around the edges, it looks like, in spite of everybody really working on it. Speak to that for a moment, because it looks to me like this is explosive. We know from Rogoff Reinhardt type guys that you reach a certain point where your government expenditures are too high and it's regressive on the economy. Talk a little bit about what I refer to as a demographic time bomb with the entitlements of the baby boomers.
Sure. Well, one thing is clear is that the Democratic Party did not want to reform entitlements, and the Republican Party under President Trump has said no reforms to entitlements. So that means that there is no political party today advocating structural reform of entitlement spending. There are Republicans individually who will do that, but they're kind of outnumbered. The Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent in his Senate confirmation hearing also confirmed that this administration is not really aiming at cutting entitlements. And what we've seen just over the past week is we've seen sparring between the House Budget Committee Chairman and the House Ways and Means Committee Chairman over whether Medicare and Medicaid could be touched. It's the third rail of politics, and that was pretty well known. And the point of view of the Trump administration and this current Republican single party control that we have, they're really not wanting to deal with that long-term issue. The other thing is that to do that, they would have to alienate those baby boomer voters who
Right.
you're referring to. And of course, Congress people are not stupid. The next election is 21 months away. So
Right.
they're not going to go after people's retirements or their benefits, in this kind of environment. What they really are going to have to do is make a break between I think that the debate is whether Generation X is going to see cuts to its entitlements, or whether Generation X and the baby boomers will be given a free pass, and then the millennials will see cuts to their entitlements. And I think that's probably the most likely, is that over the next 10 years, inflationary forces will probably force Congress at some point to do something about entitlements. But it will be, and it, of course, it'll be taken, there'll be an element of cutting spending, but there'll also probably be at that time an element of raising taxes, and there'll probably be a higher inflation rate. And all those things will be means of trying to manage this problem. But it's probably the millennials and younger that will actually see their benefits rolled back. I don't think there's a political path to cutting what baby boomers will receive from the federal government.
Well, I agree with you on that for sure. And this starting to remind me more and more of the late 70s, the Carter years. Kind of like, okay, well, this sounds kind of familiar. I think I've seen this movie before. Let's jump into something a little more explosive. I mentioned on the beginning of the show that you shocked me. And I really, literally, I did a double take. I went, wait a minute, wait a minute, wait. Let me go back and reread what I think you just said. And it was true. I've never seen you, and I'm saying this in positive. I've never seen you be a sensationalist, overestimate, try to exaggerate. To me, your analysis has been spot on and extremely accurate. And when I read that you said that the odds of a problem with a black swan, of course, we've been talking about black swans on our show for a number of months, but a black swan's something you can't necessarily predict is going to happen. Statistically, when I read your five black swans for 2025 newsletter, and by the way, if you want to get a copy of this, we'll see if we can get you a complimentary copy. Those of you, just send us an email and I'll ask the guys if they'll send out something which I think would be beneficial for them to read. And it's on the front of it is Iran's nuclear program taking flight. And I'm looking at the advanced centrifuges of Iran. Of course, I'm not a nuclear expert, but before Trump took office, it looks like you're around 300 or 400 of them. And now we're at 12,000 of them in Iran. And when you said that, and this is where I did the double take, when you said the odds, in your opinion, of Israel taking on Iran in 2025 was 75%, that's where I went back and I did the double take. I went, wait, 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 wait. I've never seen him put that high of odds on anything. I agree with your analysis, but please elaborate to our audience what the heck is going on here. It looks to me like we could have an existential problem with the Middle East right now.
Yeah, thank you. Well, so I've been following the story my whole career. We're 18 years for me watching this Iran saga. And ultimately, what the saga is about is whether Iran can obtain a nuclear weapon. And from their perspective, they need that in order to secure their regime over the long term, to make the Islamic revolution permanent. And that was the logic that other states used in obtaining nuclear weapons, including the Communist Party of China, which was very worried that they wouldn't be able to last forever, but they knew that a nuclear weapon would be their ticket to eternity. And most recently, we've seen North Korea obtain nuclear weapons after a series of negotiations with the U.S., where effectively, when the U.S. was looking at them, they would freeze or conduct or negotiate or maybe even do a short deal. But then, as soon as the U.S. looked the other direction, they would keep marching in the direction of their strategic objective, and they ultimately obtained it. Now, the dynamic is that the Iranians have learned from this process. They learned that, if you're Pakistan or you're North Korea and you really stick to your guns, you will eventually obtain a nuclear weapon. On the other hand, if you trade it away on promises, you end up looking like Libya or Ukraine, both of which gave up nuclear weapons only to be invaded later. So the Iranians have a very clear calculus, a strategic calculus, which is bent on deterrence. And they also are going through some internal problems as well. Ali Khamenei, the supreme leader, is in his mid-80s, so he's not going to last very long. And he's jockeying to get his son to be the successor and to take over when he dies. And that's a very sensitive time for any regime to be having a succession and to be simultaneously under attack by Israel. And of course, they chose to pursue a conflict with Israel during that sensitive period. So there was a question: would they retreat into their turtle shell and sort of hide from the world while they did a power succession, or would they be aggressive? Well, we know the answer because Hamas and Hezbollah and the Houthis have been very active. And that's what provoked Israel to go on this offensive. Well, Israel's now got the upper hand, not only by decimating Hamas and pushing back Hezbollah, but also ultimately we saw Syria collapse, which was a keystone to the Iranian strategic agenda in the region. What this means is that Iran is extremely vulnerable, and the Israelis have a huge opportunity. From Israel's point of view, this is the chance to reassert what is called the Begin Doctrine, prevent other countries in the region from obtaining nuclear weapons, set back that nuclear program, and also undermine the regime and try to make sure that when this succession process happens in Iran, that it's not just business as usual, but perhaps there'll be an opening for real political change in the country. Israel would be very reluctant to miss this opportunity, and certainly Benjamin Netanyahu would be. But I like to emphasize for listeners, this isn't all about personalities. You know, if Netanyahu falls from power because of internal political machinations, and suddenly you have a new prime minister of Israel, they still have an historic strategic opportunity to set back Iran and make sure they don't get a nuclear weapon. And the Americans are involved in this, obviously, because first of all, in order to truly cripple the nuclear program, Israel needs American support. The U.S. has also said it's a red line that Iran doesn't get nuclear weapons, and that's been under multiple presidencies. So the issue is that President Trump is interested in negotiating with Iran. He wants to freeze their nuclear program, but he has to start by enforcing the oil sanctions, which President Biden was not enforcing. Then he's putting maximum pressure on Iran. The Supreme Leader said, well, I don't want to talk to Trump. He's not reliable. And Israel's point of view is that it's probably better to ask for forgiveness than permission, meaning that they could escalate the conflict and draw the Americans into the conflict. So I think this is a true crisis point. I do put a date on it in saying it's in our 12-month forecast that this will be a major crisis. The crisis can be resolved by diplomacy. I would never say never. I would never say that there's no diplomatic solution. But the trends that I've witnessed over the past several years have convinced me that the diplomatic solution is lower probability. And that's specifically because the US and Iran did work out a nuclear deal and it collapsed. And from Iran's point of view, the Americans betrayed it. From the American point of view, the Iranians never intended to really fulfill it in a good spirit. And so I think there's a lack of trust. And I think obviously Israel believes that, especially in the wake of what happened with Hamas. So all of this leads to a critical juncture. It leads to a conflict. The only way to stop it would be if President Trump uses military, overwhelming military threats to force Iran to freeze their nuclear program. So that means that we should expect the US at some point to threaten Iran in a really significant way, looking as if we are going to attack them. The other thing is that President Trump would also have to restrain Israel, saying, look, I've got this. I'm in control. I can cause Iran to freeze their nuclear program. And then that way you don't have to go and do anything unilaterally. And Trump has to do both of those things in order for us to avoid a really major conflict this year. And I think the takeaway for investors is, first of all, we'll have the fire and fury when Trump is threatening Iran. Second of all, Iran will conduct strikes against oil facilities on at least on a minor basis to show the risk of confronting Iran. And then third of all, if things go wrong, well, we may well end up with a big oil shock.
Sounds fairly likely. Obviously, we want to always leave room for something might work out. But go back over. You said two things have to happen. Two things have to happen. Trump has to do this, and that this has to happen. What are those two things again?
Trump has to threaten Iran with a credible threat that the US is willing to conduct airstrikes so that they freeze their nuclear program without us having to do that.
Okay.
And the second part is he has to restrain Israel. He has to tell Israel, look, the United States is in control of the region and we are going to stop them from getting a nuclear weapon. And therefore, you do not need to take unilateral action.
So those two things are critical, and that's gonna that could blow the whole world up this year, or maybe not. I don't want to blow your horn too much, but I thought it was
No.
amazing when I read this, and it's like 75% probability. I'm like, wow, that just got my attention in a big way.
Well,
So.
if I could, I'd just say one thing about methodology and forecasting. Obviously, none of us know what's going to happen in the future. The key saying that and putting time frames on this is what we see is that the Iranians have enough highly enriched uranium to build 10 nuclear devices in 1 month if they want to. And they have not yet made that decision to do that. We also see that conflict has already erupted in the region with Israel and with Iran. So there are direct hostilities already between the two players. Iran is expanding rather than freezing its nuclear program. And the new American administration is generally quite supportive of Israel and quite hardline on Iran. So those are the ingredients here. Whether this all materializes is an open question, but I would say that the urgency is a critical part of the analysis where if Israel misses this opportunity, if they wait around for 5 years, they might have a less friendly US administration. They might have a new regime in Iran. You know, if Iran has a succession process and they've got a new young leader where they're all feeling a lot more confident, and Iran might get more weapons support from Russia and China over that time period. So that's where we have a window of opportunity that says that this is really a more urgent issue for this year or maybe next year, as opposed to kicking the forecast down the line and saying, oh, at some point there will be a conflict.
Well, that's excellent in terms of the time frame and the urgency, because it's easy for us over here. I'm in Texas, you're in Kansas, and we're like, okay, well, yeah, that would have shook up the stock market, oil, the whole world. But if you lived in Israel, it would be a different story. To them, it's we've been embattled for our whole life, since 1948, and it's an existential battle. We might not live through this if we don't take this action now, and here's our window of opportunity. That says a whole lot. So we'll see if Trump can be successful in working out something diplomatically or not. Whew, what a risk to the world right now.
All right, well, that's where we're going to stop the interview for today. Again, that's just the first half. Next week, we have the second half where Matt will address what's going on with Russia and Ukraine, what's going on with China, and then we get even specifically into the China South Sea. So we highly encourage you to catch that interview next week also. And again, if you ever miss an interview or part of an interview, part of a show, you're thinking, man, I wish I'd heard more of that, you can always go to our website, cornerstonereport.com, to listen to previous shows and interviews. Or your favorite podcast, you can just go back at the previous shows. So, Jerry, any final thoughts on the interview with Matt Gerken?
Yeah, I do. And again, we it's very clear to me that I mentioned this at the beginning of the show. It was a shock to me that he put 75% odds of the U.S. or not the U.S. doing it, Israel doing it, and Trump backing them. And I've gotten some other confirmation from other sources that are, quote, secret, if you will. But, it's interesting, too. I saw a report, one of the news reports, I can't place exactly where I got it, and Trump just basically came out and said, if Iran is successful at taking me out, I already have instructions on what they're to do in writing. We have a game plan. And basically, they would become nuclear waste at that point if they do, if they take Trump out. And he's flat out said, if they manage to kill me, here's what the military is already set up to do. I'm like, wow, this is, as the old Chinese proverb said, may you live in interesting times. So we got potential hotspot with North Korea, not too worried about them right now. Potential hotspot long term with China, which we'll talk with Matt about next week.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I'm not too worried about them right now either. I'm not too worried about Russia right now either. The issue is, are we going to have allies with Russia, with Iran, with North Korea and China? Those are the bad players in my perspective globally right now, the ones that are important. Will we take Iran out before a World War III starts? Will we not? I don't know. All I can tell you is that right now, and most of you have heard us talk, and if you haven't heard this, about talking about the fourth turning, number four, fourth turning, I've been reading the sequel to it, and I still like the first book better. The first book, to me, you can get it on Amazon. You can get it used if you want. But it's called The Fourth Turning by Neil Howe and William Strauss, who's late William Strauss. But it talks about the kind of cataclysmic changes that societies go through about every 80 to 100 years. And in those cataclysmic changes, you're talking about caterpillar to a butterfly kind of thing. then in the middle, the chrysalis phase, which is when the fourth turning occurs, which is what we're in right now. You can see that clearly if you just look at society, look at the riots. I mean, oh, give me a break, Philadelphia Eagles fans. I mean, come on, you won the Super Bowl and you tore up your own town over this. I mean, come on. Anyway, so the bottom line is, and I don't have anything against homeless, but drive around, you see the encampments now starting in Dallas. This is just, we're in a historic period of time, and in that period of time, the objective is to reformat America, get stronger so we're all fighting a common enemy, not fighting each other, and then reformat our future together for our kids and our grandkids. That's what I think we're facing. That's what's happening in our generation. We'll talk more with Matt Gerken about all these issues next week.
Jerry Tuma Smart Money is a broadcast of Cornerstone Financial Services of Dallas, Texas. Jerry Tuma is a certified financial planner. Financial advisors at Cornerstone could help you if you prefer to delegate your investment decisions to a financial professional. Securities and advisory services offered through Independent Financial Group, LLC, a registered investment advisor, member FINRA SIPC. Cornerstone Financial Services and Independent Financial Group, LLC, are unaffiliated entities. We publish a newsletter, Cornerstone Report, which is available on our website or by calling our toll-free number at 800-327-4285. That's also the number to call for more information about anything we've discussed during today's broadcast. For more information, visit our website at cornerstonereport.com. Views and opinions heard on Jerry Tuma's Smart Money are not necessarily the opinion of this station or its management or Independent Financial Group, LLC, its affiliates, officers, or directors. Material on this program is intended for general information only and should not be taken as specific investment, tax, or legal advice. Remember, we are aiming to change the way America thinks about investing.